This group today is we're trying to discuss roles for aging people in our society. I would like to start out with something that isn't quite in the line of the theme of the day, but I've been trying to figure all week where to get it in, and I think I would like to do it today just because I feel in the mood for it myself, and maybe it'll get us started thinking. But an experience that isn't uncommon, almost all of us in this group today are older people, except for one or two exceptions, and an experience that I think may be fairly common for all of us has become quite real for Carola and me during the last year, year and a half. Six of our close friends, and I mean people with whom we have been intimately connected as friends and colleagues, for many, many years, have either died or have contracted debilitating diseases that have almost destroyed their ability to function effectively in life. We have had four friends in the last year and a half who have died. Some of them after lengthy illnesses, some of them fairly suddenly, but all within their 60s and 70s. Mostly in their 70s. And then we have at least two intimate friends who have contracted, as I said, very debilitating illnesses. I can think of one, for example. Kroll and I were down in Arkansas 2 years ago taking a float trip down the White River, which is a fast whitewater river, with a couple who are good friends of ours and another couple of our age, and just had a marvelous time out on this vigorous river, fishing trout and rafting down this whitewater river. And now the man who was our host on that trip has had two strokes and has had a heart bypass operation, and in the process of the heart bypass, some kind of clotting took place, and he's now living in an almost vegetative stage. And we've been down to visit him, and it's a difficult thing to contemplate this man who's been so vigorous and so outgoing and interested in the world and so on, to see him lying there in a vegetative stage. And when we talk about roles for the elderly, which is a positive, forward-looking kind of thing, I always have hanging over me this sort of sense that those of us who are getting older always have lying around out there the probability, or possibility at least, that sooner or later, we may be in the same boat. Now, I kind of hate to bring this all up, while we're here at Holden, and yet I don't think we can talk about aging and communicate with each other effectively about aging unless we at least acknowledge that. Now, I'm not trying to elicit a lot of discussion of this necessarily, but I think that I wanted to kind of bring that out, because I think we all deal with that as a reality. And I don't know how apprehensive you are about this or how sanguine you are about it or how you have dealt with this in your own life as you plan your older age. And I would say that to those of you who are younger in the group here, these are the kinds of things that I think we should be beginning to deal with in middle age, and many of us do not. But as I sat down to prepare these discussion groups on aging and changing and roles for aging and so on, I couldn't help but but be made much more conscious of the fact that just within our intimate acquaintanceship, we have had to deal with the loss of not only the physical loss in the sense of death, but the loss in the sense of communication with very, very significant people in our lives. And that has been a rather profound kind of thing. Anybody want to comment on that at all? This is just something that I felt I'd like to get out, at least as part of the context in which we're talking about aging.
Now, you mentioned reality. I think we all realize the reality of it, but then it's just lip service that we should send concentration on the action of accepting that.
Okay.
And from that, do something, because I think we really, in death and in suffering and that, and I have a sister who's incapacitated now with the advanced stages of it's very painful to even visit her. But I think we need to concentrate on the joy and the future of it, that these individuals and ourselves. We say, well, we're getting to this age that we have to. Well, let us rejoice that we have lived the years that we have and enjoyed the things that we have, because there are hordes and hordes of people who have not had that privilege in God, and work from that aspect.
Okay. Anybody else have any comments?
Well, if you think about it a lot, it would frighten you. But you have to live one day at a time.
Okay.
And keep yourself busy.
All right. We're going to talk a little about keeping busy as we get on today. But any other thoughts? Well, I didn't want to dwell on this. And I certainly didn't want to make this the subject of a discussion today, because I don't think that's our purpose. But I did want to lay it out, because it's I think that, as I said, we need to keep our mortality in mind as we think about our life and our roles. I think that, As I mentioned yesterday, we who are older need to keep in mind that when Christ called us into this world to live and to serve, that he wasn't talking only about the so-called time of our life in which we're in our working life. That call to serve and to be something significant in the world in terms of what we are and what we can do is something that is a lifetime call. And yet, as we have pointed out, society tends to limit us. The attitudes of society toward older people tend to limit the kind of roles we play, the concept of retirement, the concept of decline, as we talked about in old age, and our own thinking about what it means to grow old frequently limit us in the scope that we have in reaching out to serve other people. But nonetheless, it's there. And I think this is what you're talking about when you said keep busy. Certainly it's more than just keeping busy, and I know you meant more than that too, but we are called to an active role, which is in a sense keeping busy. I have a book here by Paul Tournier, who is a Swiss physician, philosopher, has written a good many books. I'm sure many of you are acquainted with some of the things that Tournier has written. He's written a book called Learn to Grow Old, and I think it's worthwhile reading. It's a really fascinating book, and I got a lot out of reading it. Now, Attorney A says that he divides life into two phases. He says that, first of all, there's a natural phase in life in which we're engaged in learning, growing up, we become married, we beget children, we acquire skills, we earn money, we acquire social status, we build a profession or a way of work, or whatever it may be. He calls that the natural phase, all of those processes that we go through that build up a life. And then he divides the rest of life into what he calls a cultural phase, in which he says that as the natural phase begins to culminate, and we have had our children, and we have been successful or unsuccessful, whatever it may be, in our profession, and we've made the bulk of our living, and we've sort of established a place in society, or whatever our social status may be, that then we begin to come into what he calls a cultural phase. And that, he thinks, involves a reawakening to who we are. We've been involved into the world. We've been involved with our children. We've been involved with our job. We've been involved with acquiring skills. We've been involved with all of the things that pull us outward. Now, Tournier says that the cultural phase, which he considers the later part of life, should be involved with reawakening of ourselves as individuals, the development of personal resources, becoming a person again. And I'd like to read you a passage where he discusses this. He quotes Jung and Freud in here too, so there's quite a bit on this, but he says, in order to make a success of the first phase, which we call the natural life, it is necessary to specialize, to attain a high degree of culture in a restricted field, inevitably at the expense of a broad cultural horizon. The active person allows many of his talents to lie fallow in order to develop a few which are indispensable to his profession and social success. The integration to which Jung calls him in the second half of his life, this new advance toward a more complete human fulfillment, involves the reawakening of everything that he has for a long time had to sacrifice in his career. By the way, I'm using sexist language now, but I'm reading Tournier, so let's... it talks about his career and his retirement and so on, and I want you to know I was conscious of that as I read this, but I'll blame it on Tournier. After all, he's a European, you know, and they don't. In the same way, active life demands a measure of conformity. A man, he says, a person must play society's game if he is not to be rejected by society. He must act the conventional part that society imposes upon him. But later on, the time comes to break free from this social conditioning, when a person can rediscover his spontaneity and his originality in order to become himself once more. Jung asserts that it is a matter of discovering the values of the personality, of grasping intelligently the meaning of individual life. Thus, the cultural phase is the one in which we are called to become more personal, to become persons, to face old age with all our natural resources. We measure our success in negotiating the first Freudian turning point, becoming adult, in terms of our success in love and in our career. Later on, the success we make of retirement will be the test of our success in negotiating the second Jungian turning point, the maturity of the person. Well, this is a pretty complex kind of concept, but I think what Turnier is trying to say here, and Jung, who is his colleague, is trying to say here that the first part of our lives, the first half or whatever, are so involved in these natural processes of procreation, of job securing, of status in society, and so on, that we don't really become persons. This is what he's saying. We become acting beings. Now, as we get into older age, now's the time, he says, we can begin to integrate all of this and really, really become persons. Now, I have read through Turnier, and I also have read through a number of other books on aging, and I get a little bit confused about this business. Turnier talks a lot about the fact that in older age we should learn to meditate, we should learn to turn inward on our lives and contemplate who we are, and so on. They don't really get very much into how older people really act, you know. What older people really do. It's a little difficult to nail that down in some of these dissertations on older age and retirement. How to do it kinds of books are not, well, there are some around, but they tend to get to be a little bit on the trite side. Okay. Anybody want to comment on what Turnier has said here about the natural phase of life and the and then the cultural phase?
I find it a very helpful way of dividing the issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think he has said it very well. It brings to mind a quotation which I have used over the years from Emerson. The best use of life is to spend it for that which will outlast it. So you move from that one arena that you described into the other.
Mm-hmm.
But the ongoing purpose is to spend yourself to use what you are and what you have for those things that will carry on when you are done.
Mm-hmm.
And the Lord says, fine, we think this is a good cutting off point. When that comes, to be at peace with that. And there are so many possibilities in which we can continue to spend our lives. Not necessarily getting paid for it,
mm-hmm.
Probably not getting paid for it, but that's incidental to what's happened.
Okay.
I guess those are the things that were triggered, mm-hmm. Comments were triggered by the point you made.
Yeah.
There really are wonderful new doors, open possibilities of getting at service and insight and growing that you really didn't have time for.
Okay, that leads into what I think I would like to get into today, is to talk about that. Before we do, however, I'd like to just pursue this other thing just a little bit further. I read a book by Bianchi called Why Survive? And it's I think, somewhat a pessimistic book, because he contends that the world today tends to relegate older people to a situation where they really can't do what you're talking about, Ray. Significantly make a contribution in life. I think it's quite a big, thick book, but if I look at the ultimate conclusion of it, he feels that the kind of society we live in, which has become so technological and so rapidly moving and so oriented toward achievement and youth and so on, that it's very difficult for older people to exactly find what those kinds of roles are that you talk about, serving, being, and so on.
I don't believe that.
Well, I know, but I'm trying to say that a lot of people think that. Now, Tournier, even, I think, has a certain amount of that in this book here. He talks about quite a bit in this book about how modern society depersonalizes people, and especially older people. Let me read a little portion here.
30-40 years ago, yes.
He says, technical competence is essential to professional success. By the way, he speaks out of a profession, so this is the way he comes. Every profession has its technical problems. While people are still at work, technical conversations form a bond between them and create the illusion of personal relationships. But when retirement comes along, then we have nothing more to do with the great technical machine. Then we are no longer one of the team. We realize that we no longer know what to talk about. We have no bond with those who are in technical society. And we have forgotten the speech of personal relationships. This is when a man finds out the extent to which he has been conditioned by a depersonalized society. In Paul Ricoeur's words, this soulless world secretes boredom, a boredom which makes people a prey to anxiety. Even young people are aware of this. At the height of one's career, the work itself provides distraction. But in retirement, boredom will reappear and become an obsession. Well, this is Tournier speaking. And there's quite a bit of that stuff in here.
I wasn't in the top, I just must say this.
Yeah.
I know when we moved from Long Island, New York, to the West Coast, we lost our identity. And that was very, very hard to make an identity again. And we really struggled with it there. And then when we were blue and depressed, we'd go out to the areas that looked like Long Island and kind of get back the feel of the way we had before. Then one day we got together and we decided that now let's look over the goals we had as young people and see if we have accomplished as much as we have wanted to personally and as a couple. And we made a list of these things and we decided that we were still able to do some of these things that we hadn't been able to do. Like we'd wanted to come to Koinonia for 30 years and hadn't been able to make it. So that was our Holden Village.
Holden Village.
Yes.
This is Koinonia.
And we had wanted to come here and hadn't been able to do it. Well, we decided a lot of these things. And then we had wanted to have a home paid for and a car paid for, so we got that all out of the way. And then we felt at least when the time came where one or the other of us was left alone, we could at least say that we had tried to accomplish together the things we set out to do with the Lord's help and with His consideration all the way.
Okay, very good. And do you feel you're on the road on that now?
Yeah, we feel much more settled, yes, much happier.
How long
are
you?
We never were, we were happy, but we felt unnecessary because we've both been needed.
Okay.
I was a teacher, retired in children. My husband was pastor in a chapel. We've been needed for almost 24 hours a day. Now all of a sudden we had each other.
I'd like to pursue that with you a little further, but not quite at this point. You know, your previous, your careers, as you've gone through them with retarded children and as a pastor and so on, and what significance that has for the next few years. I want to bring that up later, but don't let me forget that. Yeah.
I was going to say, I'm going through something somewhat similar. I'm between jobs now. I've chosen that. I find all the things I really love to do in life and the time to reflect, I really love that. Don't pay. And I love to sing. I sing in my church choir, but I'm not going to make a living doing that. All the things I really love to do, it doesn't seem to pay, so I'm really struggling with that, and I'm 38 years old, so I mean, I'm going through a different stage of life, I'm in the midlife crisis, I guess. But I can relate to what you're saying, because all of a sudden people say, what are you doing? I say, well, I was doing that, I don't know yet what it is I'm gonna do, I'm exploring, and somehow their respect for me drops, and it's a really interesting experience. I don't wanna go through it too much longer, it's really interesting.
Okay, yeah.
I did in Eastern Washington, you know, I worked for the government over there, you know. I don't know if I told that here.
No, that's all right, go ahead.
Well, yeah.
I don't.
Anyway, there was two of the ditch riders, you know, that are gonna retire, and we had a big party on them, you know. They were 65 years old, both of them, you know. So one of them, we bought a great big rocking chair, you know, and he was just gonna take it easy, you know. And he sat down in a chair and he just gave up everything, and he only lasted 6 months.
Yeah.
He died, you know.
Sure.
I was sick and died.
Yeah.
So it goes, shows you gotta keep activity, to lose your mind and everything, you know, that it goes with it.
Okay.
And when we were down into the Desert Inn in California several years in a row, it was a place, professor there from the University of Washington lectured on and aging, and that was sort of a place for old people. So we were down there several years in a row, and she lectured, you know, on happiness and contentment and stuff like that. And it was such a meaning in life to be contented and happy. And she walked to the park and she rubbed herself on the ears and singing, and always being happy and contented, you know. And she lived to be about 96 years old.
Okay.
Died a few years ago.
Well, that's the danger then, and that's what I object to in saying that the two authors you quoted, is that they're categorizing the time element on it, and we can't, because it's individuals and we're influenced by stimuli that comes from many, many different. But I think we all know people who are already dead and retired and so forth, who are middle-aged and younger there. And then, for instance, we take people that are way in their 80s or 90s who are still there. So we don't want to concentrate too much on a span of time or a span of life. It's throughout life, until death.
Now, maybe at this point we could move into discussing a little bit about that, because I know that in this group there are many of us who have continued to be, we haven't reached a phase in life where we've sat back and just, as you say, sat in the rocking chair. I'd like to just bring up the question now, and then let's talk a little bit about meaningful roles for older people. And I'd like now to take up on what you're talking about here. Now, you were working with retarded children,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
What significance does that have for you at all in retirement? Do you have any intention of letting that influence something you're going to be doing in retirement?
Well, I worked at Western State when we first came to, and I worked in the library, and I also took a number of students and taught them individually. But you know, what was hard for me was, because when I do something, I do it wholeheartedly. Then when my husband wanted to take a trip, that meant I had to go and leave him. And those students, when I came back, they were hurt. And that hurt me. And I decided, no, I can't do that anymore. That just is not going to, I'm going to have to get new paths that is not going to work for me.
In other words, you don't feel you can carry that.
No, because of my personality. Mm-hmm. I just can't do that. Mm-hmm. I get just too hurt when I feel that I've hurt someone else because I haven't carried through. They learn to depend on you, and it can't be just a surface. You really got to give yourself when you're doing this sort of thing.
Okay,
so I found other outlets.
So you feel that the
for
kind
me, it does not work. Now,
the kind of
outlet, maybe what?
the kind of skills you developed to do that kind of job that you aren't going to use that directly now in retirement.
No, but you use those skills as you meet people, because you have to learn to read body language. You have to learn to be very sensitive mm-hmm. to other people.
Okay.
So you use those skills all the time.
Okay. So that poses somewhat of a dilemma for you then, in that suddenly the
That's
kind
right.
of thing that absorbed you is cut off,
That's
and now
right.
you have to begin to
right.
to roll
I
into
have
some
to be,
new.
I have to learn some new behaviors.
Yeah.
And new skills.
Now, what about you? Are you you were a pastor?
Yes.
The skills and the kinds of things you did as a pastor, are they carrying over into retirement?
Yes. I also was a chaplain in the VA hospital.
Okay.
And I volunteered 2 days of my time at the VA. How could I feel I still have to earn a paycheck? I just cannot relax. I feel the need, and they have a need to use me. And I'm tickled that they can use me.
Okay. All right, we've got two interesting kinds of approaches now here. Here we have one person who develops skills, who develops a meaningful serving role in life, serving retarded children with all of the kinds of insights and understandings, and suddenly she comes to a point where she says, I've got to cut that out. And then he, on the other hand, says, yeah, I can carry on the skills and the meaningfulness of my profession right on into retirement. And even though you may not get paid for it, you certainly are going to get, you know, a lot of meaningful satisfaction. Now, I don't want to put you on the spot, but does this create any problems for you and as a family? I mean, with you?
I made arrangements to do other things that I had never been able to do. For instance, I took a bridge, which I'd never been able to play.
A what?
I took a bridge to keep my mind active, which I've
okay.
never been able to do.
Okay.
I played bridge on the day that he's down for VA hospital. I Mothers of the students I talk could do this. I never could do it.
Okay.
Now I'm doing that. But sometimes I still feel it's not, well, it's a little worthless sometimes.
It isn't quite as...
It's not as quite as fulfilling.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But on the days that he gets up to go to work too, I'm telling you, boy, out and snappy it's going to be. And the days he's not, there's a difference there too.
It's an individual thing.
I didn't understand that.
It's the result or the solution is the individual thinking, but naturally it'd be among all of us. But I think one solution, and then I feel I haven't even talked with my wife on it, but I think it's beginning to work in our lives, is that there's nothing wrong if it's what we want, and there of a slight parting of the ways momentarily so we can pursue those things that are very important in our lives as long as we come back mm-hmm. together.
Yeah, and then you have something to share too.
Yeah.
Right? Otherwise, too much togetherness can get to be
But
stale.
I can recognize there again, it depends on the individual. Some people can't part, and you have to.
But they
together.
Have to, because one day we're going to be separated.
Right.
And one is going to have to function without the other.
Right.
And you have to learn to do it now. Like he's doing some of the jobs that I used to always do, and now we're taking turns at it. I haven't washed the car yet. Probably with the
Because our interests are different too in some respect.
Okay.
One way I've learned to accommodate this is I like to do stitchery and working. And I've learned to do portable things, more things that I take with me. And I used to be an active in the church. I'm not leading Bible studies anymore. We're gone too much of the time. Helping with the altar committee. But I find I can make pyramids. I make stoles or something. And I can do this while we're traveling, get new ideas as we're going. Go to Grinnell Guild and take a class or a workshop in making banners and pyramids and come back with new ideas. So
see,
they're bonus years.
I'm part gypsy.
Tournier talks quite a bit about second careers. And second careers leading out of primary careers. I think your experience of allowing your pastoral skills to move into a little different role is somewhat in that line. He cites the example of a man who retires, and he's been a skilled workman. He's developed a variety of skills with his hands in his profession. He was an electrician and a carpenter and so on. When he retires, he suddenly finds himself, you know, just suddenly with nothing to do. So he joins a workshop, an elderly workshop in town. There's an organization that has a sort of a shop, a woodworking shop. And soon he's helping others learn how to use tools. And then he helps others learn how to join things together. And he's begun to develop then a second career that is based on his first career, but it's now not a paying thing necessarily, but he's involved himself in a task where he can go 2 or 3 days a week to this workshop and there's something meaningful for him to do. Tournier feels that second careers are very important. Now he contrasts second careers with hobbies. He points out that hobbies are more time fillers, while second careers reach out into meaningful relationships with other people and so on. So Tournier, in his discussion of older age, talks about the development of second careers. And then he contrasts a primary career with a secondary career. He says a primary career requires rules. It requires maximum return. There isn't much room for imagination. There are hierarchies to deal with, the boss and the foreman and so on and so on. Hours that you have to observe, holiday times, all of this kind of thing that surround our primary career. And then he says when you get into a second career, you can kind of adjust all of those things. You can exercise more freedom. You can do things on your own time. You don't have to abide by all the rules. The penalty is that you don't get paid for it. But you get the satisfaction of having develop something that's significant. Now, the problem with talking with those of us who are retired about this is frequently it's too late by then to begin to think about developing second careers. You're the one that should be thinking about how what you do with the next 15 or 20 or 25 years of your life will help you move into older age in doing significant kinds of things. Tournier claims that the most meaningful aging comes when people have begun to plan for it and think about it when they're in their 40s and 50s, and that they then can shape their career toward a more meaningful kind of older age. Yeah?
May I share a little bit of the road I've been on?
Yes, I should say.
When I concluded my work at California Lutheran College, there were people in the community who came and said, will you spend a year with a foundation grant looking at what's happening here as a community and seeing what you think we ought to be giving attention to.
Mm-hmm.
It was a young community, what, 10,000 when we came, it is now 100,000. The way the pieces began to come together, was first to identify that we had an environmental problem coming at us. And then we had a problem in the lack of housing for elderly people. Low income people. And we were a community with no central cultural facility, no auditorium.
Mm-hmm.
And the areas of concern and interest in the community began to get identified. What happened was that we would focus on, say, on the housing for the elderly. And we would call together a dozen people, various places in the spectrum of the life of that community, saying, do you people think there is a problem?
Mm-hmm.
If so, what do you think can be done about it, if anything? And began to see that there were indeed things for independent citizens, no particular office, who could begin to work together towards some achievement. This has been happening now for, 14, 15 years. And a lot of things have changed, and it has captured the interest and abilities of a lot of people. And like throwing the stone in the water, the circles keep on and keep on and keep on. What, after you were saying that, Trigini made the point that you need to plan for what's ahead, I wanted to make this point that not necessarily.
Okay.
If you're alert, the time and the setting in which you are, and if something has happened so that you have developed the trust of at least a few people, some things can begin to take shape.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the and just spending your life can go on in a way that you really haven't anticipated. So I share it.
No.
Not necessarily the same thing will work at every place, but as a kind of a possibility, a symptom of the shift.
Yeah, two things occur to me there. One is that you really, in retirement, you began to look at your community. In other words, you may have been concentrating on the college before and so on, but now you really began to look at your community. And then secondly, you began to discover that there are a lot of people out there who have some things to contribute to that community.
And may I add the footnote that I would call people whom I had identified and asked if they would be interested. It was a rare week in which I didn't get a yes from everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Ready, interested, willing. Mm-hmm. Nobody had ever asked them.
Nobody had ever asked. Okay. That is really a key point there. We live in a rural community. And there are just endless things that need to be done in those communities, but in that community, but nobody ever asks anybody. And nobody ever calls anybody together to say, hey, let's take a hard look at this, you know. And I think that's really lacking. And that's really a key point. You've had your hand up.
Yeah, I wasn't going to speak today, but Ray brought out a point that I'd like to share with you. At Luther College in the senior year, I decided ministry was for me. But I was going to test God out first. And so I went into teaching. I taught in San Antonio, Texas schools in Big Springs, and I wanted to see if I could work with a school board. I didn't have any problem with the school board, so then I decided that, well, if I can have a good relationship with the public eye or a school board, why not the church council? So I went to the seminary, and finished the seminary and went out to Iowa State University to get a little more education. And then during this years in the ministry on Long Island, in the year 64, 65, I wanted to throw in the towel. I was getting problems at the church office that I didn't know how to handle. I didn't have any handles. Then there came an advertisement at Postgraduate Mental Health Center in Manhattan, so I took a 2 years course in counseling. What a blessing that was. And of course, it got me more qualified for the VA system. So all along the line, I hadn't really planned for the retirement part, but you were kind of led along the line to several positions and occupations in life. And it was just kind of led along the way.
Yeah.
And every step I took was a preparation.
Yeah.
Really for retirement.
Okay.
Gotcha.
I'd like to ask, maybe we should define what we mean by planning for. Sometimes I think our concept of planning for is we make a plan and we just go right down the road with that plan.
Say more about that.
I think that we have a pretty narrow, rigid definition of making a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we need to move more in the area of a plan involves some thinking ahead, not laying out a roadmap of action.
Okay.
But just thinking ahead.
Conceptualizing some things.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's where we sometimes get into this trouble of, well, we shouldn't plan ahead, because that's not faith in God then.
Okay.
We just kind of have the idea. It means faith is just sitting back and kind of letting things happen to us. And if that's, but, so I guess in a way I would disagree to say that we shouldn't make any plans. Coming from the definition of that planning means thinking ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And we may start down the road, but God may close the door for us to continue in that direction, like his experience. Doors opened up in other directions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if you keep your mind and spirit open, then those doors do keep opening up, as long as you are involved constantly in things.
Yeah. I what we said in my teaching, that a plan is only a guideline to set your course, but then you change from that. I taught engineering graphics for many years, and of course, it's quite an exact language in itself, control by rules, but I always run onto professors and also students who were so narrow in their thinking that everything had to be precise according to what's been listed by someone in a book. But I've always felt others, it's not my thinking alone, it's others, but that every law, every rule is given to be broken. If you judge, the job can be better done and you reach a goal in a more humane manner or efficient manner by bending or breaking a rule or a law, break it.
Okay.
That's what they're there for.
Not everybody would agree with that. Yeah.
I really find one of my biggest struggles in life is living the one day at a time, living by faith versus goal setting and planning ahead. Mm-hmm. And the balance between the two, to learn that art, that's what I'm trying to learn.
Now, I don't think Tournier had a rigid concept of planning ahead in mind. I think what he had in mind here was that as we invest ourselves in our careers and in our lifetime, we have to do that with a view to the long future, not with a view to coming to 65 and then stopping. I think that's what he had in mind, not this kind of rigid planning that you were referring to here, where you sit down and make a roadmap.
Yeah,
seems to me that it, in response to that, it's worth at least saying that the time in which we live really cannot anticipate that we will live out one career all the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
That there is constant shift,
yes.
Abrupt shift.
Yes. Even with young people, that's happening.
And that we need not be startled by that.
Yeah.
But there's room for some anticipation of what else am I able to do, what else interests me. And begin, as with Ted, to get some, in his case, get some additional training, recognizing that.
Yeah.
But it's true for most of the ways we have lived our lives, that if we were starting today, we could not assume that we would spend all the rest of our lives doing that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what a time women have today. Oh, you've got the whole world ahead of you, my dear, at 38.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good time. My biggest frustration is that I would like to be married and have a family. That's out of style. Women of my generation, it's
now it's
career.
Coming back. It's
I know it
back.
Is. Because we've gone too far and now it's balancing
back.
Out.
It's coming back.
Yeah. I look forward to that. I don't know about having a family, I'm getting a little old, but I really look forward to
that. But you know, that will come as you get yourself more well rounded and get yourself happy.
Yeah.
That's gonna be there.
Yeah. That's part of it. Uh-huh. It may not necessarily be, because it hasn't been for me. And I think I would say that I've had that, you know, desire too. And I guess I had a rough time in my 30s finding meaning for myself, because at that time society gave meaning to women through marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And I've come to grips with it now, but I would still be happy if it could be my future, but I don't know. You know, I'm growing up in the war years, where the balance, the ratio of the men my age was so out of balance.
I
don't know that it can be.
No.
And I came from the Vietnam era, and the same thing happened to the women in my generation.
Well, earlier in the week, and some of you weren't here, we talked about this whole business of change and how that keeps impinging on our lives, even into old age. None of us can focus directly. I can think of my own life, and Carola and I, we've had three different careers at least in our lifetime, and I think for younger people now, that's going to be even a greater kind of change. And as we've moved into older age, we're almost into another kind of career that has quite a few facets to it. So it's a changing situation. We're not on a roadmap kind of thing anymore. I'd like to raise something a little more specific, and we aren't going to get time to do it today, so I'm going to raise it again tomorrow. I don't know how many of you want to be in the group tomorrow, but anyway. Carola and I belong to a group in the American Lutheran Church which is called Probers. You know what a probe is. It's something that you stick into something. But the American Lutheran Church Division of Social Service has a group of what they call probers, about 30 people, who are given the task, each one, of probing into certain aspects of life. One of them is criminal justice, another one is homosexuality, another one is youth, another one is communities, not communes, but intentional communities, and so on and so on and so on. And Carol and I have been given the responsibility of probing into the area of aging and changing. And so one of the things that we have come up with, Carol and I, in doing this is to try to get some people together to talk about older people in the church, not how the church can serve older people, but how older people can make a more significant contribution to the life and witness of the church. As I have watched many of our congregations, I have found that older people in the congregation tend to be relegated to ushering or to counting the money after the service or this kind of thing. We were members of Westwood Church in Minneapolis, for example, which was a large, active, vital congregation, had quite a large contingency of older people, many of whom were very, very active, meaningful people throughout their career. But I didn't see Westwood very significantly utilizing those people in any significant way at all in furthering the life and mission of the congregation. And so Carol and I have been talking about trying to probe into that a little bit. And maybe tomorrow I'm going to raise the question about specifics, not the generalities that we're talking about here today, but about certain specifics. What can we as older people, or not we, but what can older people contribute to the life and mission of the church? And I'd like to be able to put down on the blackboard some specific kinds of things that older people can contribute to the life and mission of the church and to the witness of the church. It would be very helpful to us as we make this probe. And secondly, the probers are supposed to report back to the church in significant ways to help the different aspects of the church plan for ministry. The congregation, the national offices of the church, the districts, the educational programs of the church, the theological training, and all the rest of it. I think that some very significant things have come out of some of these probes as they have looked at various aspects of life and then said, hey, the church is just not dealing with this, or the church is not enabling people to do this kind, certain kinds of things. So I think tomorrow I'd like to engage whoever is coming in that kind of thinking and discussing. Not just the church, but I think the church is part of a community. Ray has already alluded to the community, and I think I'd like to expand it to that kind of thing. Okay, it's 10 minutes to 12, so I think we better quit now, and we'll look forward to that tomorrow.